I'm Laurel Bowman. Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine's party said Sunday that it was preparing to challenge President Yoweri Museveni's election victory and condemned what it called the house arrest of Wine and his wife. A spokesman for Wine's National Unity Party, or NUP, said they had evidence of ballot stuffing and other forms of malpractice and planned to use it to challenge the election. On Saturday, the Electoral Commission declared Museveni the winner of Thursday's vote, with final counts showing the president won 59% of votes to Wine's 35%. Museveni is 76 years old and is one of Africa's longest-serving leaders. He's been in power since 1986. After he was declared winner, he said that the election may turn out to be the most cheating-free in Uganda's history. And he added that his government would deal decisively with anyone who disrupted peace in the country. Meantime, Wine's party said the opposition leader and his wife are unable to leave their home, which it said is surrounded by soldiers and police who are blocking members of his party and journalists from entering. On Saturday, a military spokesman told Reuters that security officers at Wine's house were assessing threats he could face and might be preventing him from leaving for his own safety. In the United States, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris will resign her Senate seat on Monday, 2 days before she and President-elect Joe Biden are inaugurated. Aides to the California Democrat confirmed the timing and said Governor Gavin Newsom was aware of her decision, clearing the way for him to appoint fellow Democrat Alex Padilla, now California's Secretary of State, to serve the final 2 years of Harris's term. For more on this, visit voanews.com. This is VOA News, and here are some of the top stories related to the global coronavirus pandemic. Britain's government hopes to ease some lockdown restrictions in March as it presses ahead with Europe's fastest rollout of COVID-19 vaccines. Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said Sunday, the country, which also has Europe's highest COVID-19 death toll, has been under national lockdown since January 5th, with schools closed for most pupils, non-essential businesses shut, and people ordered to work from home where possible. India's COVID-19 vaccination drive hit a bump on the first day due to glitches in an app called Cowin. It's being used to coordinate the campaign. That's according to several officials involved in the immunization program. Prime Minister Narendra Modi launched what his government has described as the world's largest vaccination program on Saturday to rein in. Which has reported the second highest number of cases after the United States. Worry simmered in mainland China about a potential fresh wave of coronavirus cases ahead of the Lunar New Year next month, as authorities on Sunday reported 109 new COVID-19 cases, most of them in the province surrounding Beijing. Though the January 6th tally of new cases was less than the previous day's 130, China has in the past week seeing the number of daily cases jump to over 10-month high. Lebanon's caretaker health minister signed a final deal on Sunday to secure 2.1 million doses of Pfizer's BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. As that country battles a steep rise in infections, the vaccines are expected to arrive in batches starting February. That's what the ministry said in a statement. And the second batch of Russia's Sputnik V Corona vaccine arrived in Argentina on Saturday, allowing the South American country to apply the second part of the two-dose program aimed at inoculating frontline workers. Some 300,000 doses of the vaccine arrived from Moscow on a special flight of Argentina's flag carrier airline. Gunmen shot dead two Afghan women judges working for the Supreme Court in an early morning ambush in the country's capital Sunday, officials said, as a wave of assassinations continues to rattle the nation. Violence has surged across Afghanistan in recent months, despite ongoing peace talks between the Taliban and the government. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here is the issue. After a week that saw a riot led by supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump, that breached the U.S. Capitol building in an attempted overthrow of the government and left five people dead, history was made as the House of Representatives voted to impeach Trump for the second time. House members voted on one count of inciting violence against the government of the United States. The motion was approved by a vote of 232 to 197, a tally which included 10 members of Trump's own Republican Party, making it the most bipartisan impeachment vote in history. Democrats, speaking from the same floor they were forced to flee for their lives just 1 week ago, made impassioned speeches demanding that the president be held accountable for inciting the unprecedented melee that tore through the Capitol. Republican arguments defending the president ranged from lukewarm to defiant. Notable among the 10 who voted to impeach was Representative Liz Cheney, a prominent figure in the Republican House delegation and daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Trump, banned from the social media outlets that he has depended on throughout his political life, has been largely silent in the days following the insurrection, save for one public appearance where he professed that he had done, quote, nothing wrong. Following the impeachment vote, Trump released a statement disavowing the violence at the Capitol and bemoaning the social media ban, but making no mention of the impeachment vote. The article now goes to the Senate for a trial. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he will not reconvene the Senate for an emergency session before Trump leaves office, leaving it to the incoming Democrat-led Senate to manage an impeachment trial at the same time it tries to launch the agenda of soon-to-be President Joe Biden. Emily, JJ, welcome. Good morning. And we keep saying it over and over again for 4 years, but we have unprecedented events to talk about today. The president being impeached twice, half the impeachments in U.S. history have the name of Donald Trump on them. I just want to jump right in with you, Emily. The charge that was a president, could you give like a brief explanation of what the charge is? And can charges be added to this, or is it likely to be just the one count that goes to the Senate?
So inciting an insurrection is, it kind of does what it says on the tin, right? He was charged with, I guess, to use a metaphor, sparking the fuse that led to the mob storming the Capitol in the weeks of denying the legitimacy of the election, and then more to the point in this rally that in calling his supporters to town on January 6th and having this rally and sort of whipping up the crowd. I think that it will probably just be this. I think the House wanted to sort of do it one and done and pass it along to the Senate. I would also just note that while it is historic that the president managed to get impeached twice in one four-year term, as he is leaving in a week anyway, the impact will really be felt if the Senate convicts, obviously not just to remove from office, but because he'll be gone, but convicts to bar him from ever holding office again. So history is still unfolding on this one.
JJ, let's go to you. We have the arguments for impeachment, the Democrats and the Republicans giving their respective positions on this. Were there any arguments or speeches on either side that stood out for you?
No. And considering that I stay away from politics, I would have to comment on this from a security point of view. What I heard from some people seemed to add credence to this divide or divorce from reality by some people. We all saw what happened. We all saw what led up to it. And as you mentioned, Michael, when we started this, we've been talking about this for years. And having been on this program for several years, certainly since 2016 or shortly thereafter, this has been a big topic. And that big topic being things like, quote, alternative facts, or things like the president's viewpoint, which is different from reality. And just basically the trafficking in lies. What took place on the floor was more of that in some situations where people didn't even address what took place in the president's speech, didn't even address what it essentially was doing, and, you know, did not connect it to what took place at the Capitol. Instead, we're talking about what Democrats do, how Democrats are, or how other political parties and other people act and what they've done, not addressing the critical point that faces this nation right now. So that's what I took most note of from many of the speeches that took place on the floor. There was this divide.
Yeah, and as you say, speaking from the security aspect, they were literally speaking from a crime scene, making these arguments. It was really just stunning and affecting to watch. Emily, I'll turn to you with the same question. Of the speeches that you saw on the floor, both defending and indicting the president, were there any that stood out in your mind?
Yes, there were two on each side. So on the Democratic side, I was really struck by Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas saying, what do you think they would have done if they had gotten in? What do you think they would have done to you? And who do you think sent them here? That to me was chilling. It drove home how close Democrats and Republicans in Congress came to, you know, what happened on January 6th was horrible, but this recalled for me how much worse it could have been. The other one was Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who said that it was a bit much to hear that the mob that tried to kill them would have been less angry had they been a little bit nicer. I think that that, to me, illustrated what I think rings hollow to many about this argument that, well, if you impeach, then we're not going to heal. If you impeach, then there won't be unity. If you impeach, then we're going to be really mad. And it's sort of like, well, you already stormed the Capitol, right? How much more anger and divisions there going to be? On the Republican side, you know, there were many who said, I think that this is an impeachable offense, but I don't think that it's right for the nation, or who said, well, let's have a bipartisan commission instead. I was struck, though, by Matt Gaetz of Florida, who got up and spoke about the Biden crime family, right? Just showing that there are still members of Congress who are not letting the conspiracy theories from the election go. And also Lee Zeldin from New York, who spoke about MS-13 and the embassy and Trump's moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And the reason I bring this up is just that I think that there were members who voted against impeaching Trump for whom the issue was not really impeachment. It was whether their political futures would be tied to Trump or not.
Yeah, there are some members who clearly are for Trump and to the end. They will literally ride that horse into the sunset. And they made that very clear with the speeches that they gave, which made virtually no mention, as you say, of a deadly attack, which is their place of business. No, I'm going to stay with you, Emily, to talk a little bit about the president and the statements that he's given in the days since. It seems that there's sort of the seesaw of statements that he makes, where he said that he had done nothing wrong in a recent public appearance, and then later that same day gives a statement saying that he denounces all violence and no one violent is a supporter of his. Which one of these represents the real Donald Trump?
You know, I'm a little surprised that every time he puts out one of these slightly calmer videos, people sort of go for it, right? And say that, well, now that was a good statement. And you know what? I think they're both Donald Trump, because the one is obviously the sort of the public showman Donald Trump that people who go to his rallies love. But the other is still Donald Trump, because he is telling people what he thinks they want to hear, which I think is also something that we've seen Trump do repeatedly as a candidate and as president.
JJ, we have this impeachment that has happened. We have had this process that's gone through the House of Representatives, and we're going to have a trial. How important is it for this to happen for national security? Can we actually count on a resolution of what is a growing domestic terrorist threat without holding people responsible for their actions, both the people who actually did the actions, who breached the walls, and the people who incited them to do it?
Yeah, I'd like to point out two things for your consideration on this. On the day this riot took place, we have video images of people with ropes, ladders, sledgehammers, hockey sticks, metal pipes, flex cuffs or zip ties, people with weapons, guns. Two pipe bombs were planted. More were found. Molotov cocktails were found. One police officer was beaten and dragged into a mob. We saw people breaking into a window of the Capitol, and they were using a police shield to do it. There is no way to uncouple this from national security, and there is no way that national security can be, I guess, restored until this is dealt with. And the reason why is because those people were supposedly protesters, but protesters don't carry around those items. How did they get to those items to the Capitol? How come nobody saw them? How did they get into the Capitol? How did they know where to go? To places that weren't identified or places that were nondescript. What were their motives once they got in there? This is a part of the problem that we're facing here. There's no way to deal with this without fixing some very serious blame to some very influential people. You know, I'm hinting at what's been called an inside job here. These folks had some help one way or another to get in there. And that is a direct impact on national security because these are members of Congress. One member, a former Secret Service deputy director, told me yesterday, the only way to prevent this from happening again is to declare any joint meeting of Congress a national special security event, just like the State of the Union is, just like the inaugural is, just like any meeting where you have a joint session of Congress because of the import of the people that are there at that time. The only way to deal with that is from a national security perspective. So that has to be dealt with as we look at this. And the other part of this, too, is where did this come from? It came from the commander in chief. And that's what the investigators are looking at right now. They believe that this was a call to action that was answered.
We'll come back to more of the inside job thread and see what type of collaboration may have happened. First, we'll take a break. We'll come back with more issues in the news.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for The New Statesman. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Emily, I want to go to you. Mitch McConnell has been quoted as saying that he supports impeachment of President Trump and conviction. And he thinks that the Republican Party reportedly needs to make a break. A clean break from Trump. This is obviously new, hasn't happened before. He's been a staunch supporter of the president and the policies that he's put forward, the judges, all of these things. What has been the tipping point for McConnell? Is it really the policy? Was it something else? Was it really the sight of the violence? And what effectively can he do? Can he really make a break from Trump and still have a viable U.S. political party?
It's a really interesting question and also situation that we find ourselves unpacking here. One wonders if this had happened during Trump's term and not at the very, very end of it, if McConnell would be distancing himself similarly. I think a few things are going on here. First of all, while he did stand by for the many weeks that Trump was saying that the election had been stolen, you know, sort of refused to denounce the conspiracy theories, one might say created some of the conditions that led to the anger and frustration that we saw on January 6th, I can appreciate that seeing a mob storm your workplace can change one's mind. I think the cynical read is that they now have an opportunity to make it so that Trump can never hold office again. They can just get rid of this political opponent and sort of reclaim the Republican Party from Trump. The problem is, as we saw yesterday, there was much ado about the fact that Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, this prominent figure in the Republican Party, was voting for impeachment. Well, only 9 House Republicans joined her, right? And so even if McConnell's privately suggesting that he supports impeachment, I don't know that he's going to get 16 other Republican senators to join him to get Democrats to that 2/3 majority. And the reason is that if you looked at the YouGov poll that came out right after the storming of the Capitol, 45% of Republicans supported the mob, and 85% of Republicans said they did not support the immediate removal of Trump. So Donald Trump Jr. said at the rally in the morning of January 6th that it's not establishment Republicans, Republican Party, it's his father's Republican Party. And I actually think that there is some truth in that. I think that many elected Republicans know that Trump still enjoys or believe that Trump still enjoys a lot of support with their voters. So I don't know where the Republican Party goes from here. If these sort of quote unquote establishment Republicans can claw back those voters, if they can actually purge Trump from the party, or if in letting this go on for 4 years, they've lost control.
Let me throw some more cynicism at you, Emily. In recent days, major corporations have said that they will withdraw and cease funding of Republican candidates going forward that have associated themselves with the Republican Party because of the violence at the Capitol. One could say that in that sense, Mitch McConnell might be even more anxious for a conviction of Donald Trump than Chuck Schumer, the incoming majority leader, if the corporate donor spigot is turned off by association with Trump. Thoughts?
I actually thought, I had this thought the other day, that they have to be more afraid of capitalism than Trump supporters to do this, right? So they have to be more, they have to be more convinced that their backers, that their mega donors and the companies that support them, they have to be more afraid that they're going to walk away than the Trump supporters are going to walk away. And right now, I'm not, I could be wrong. I'm just not sure that that's the calculation that most Republican senators have made at this point.
Okay. JJ, we have more troops right now in Washington, D.C. than we have in Afghanistan. The building where I work is completely surrounded by troops. There are military checkpoints that you would see when you're doing overseas reporting. It's, I'm not going to say unprecedented, because we had 9/11. We've had other situations where we have seen National Guard here in this city, but I don't know that I've seen this many and have them on such a sense of high alert. What's the prospect for security here in the nation's capital going forward? Because people stormed the Capitol to interrupt a process, and that's essentially what happens every day in that building. There are processes that go on, and there are dozens, maybe hundreds of buildings in the Washington, D.C. area where that same thing happened, where the process of government goes on. Going forward, how are we going to secure this city for an inauguration? And even after that, for just the business of everyday government?
Well, you know, I agree with what you said about the overseas thing. I looked at some of the security on Capitol Hill and looking through that fence, and I just saw these hundreds. Then I guess looking at the totality of it, thousands of guards on the Capitol grounds and around the Capitol grounds. It reminded me of one time when I was in the Green Zone in Baghdad. And I thought, wow, this is just like that. The only thing that was different was the flag was a different type of flag and the buildings looked different. The prospect for security during the inauguration is nothing to worry about, because that is locked down and it's taken care of, because the Secret Service has been planning for this for a year or more. And this climate that we're in, nothing is being left to chance. Moving forward, people have been awakened by what took place. Even those who won't vote a certain way on the Hill in terms of impeachment or not, or people who won't acknowledge what really took place, the people who are responsible for their safety, they're not playing those games. The people that are responsible for the safety of members of Congress and for people in the city, and I would argue around the country, recognize that their jobs, their livelihoods, and their own lives are at stake if they don't get this right moving forward. So security moving forward, we're back in the same kind of place we were after 9/11, because I was at the VA building on 9/11, and I can recall standing on the roof watching the Pentagon burn, but that came after I had been warned by some people that I knew in law enforcement to get out of D.C. just before that plane crashed in Shanksville, which we later learned was intended for the Capitol. We're in that same mindset and situation now, because people are going to have to deal with what led up to this and how do we fix this. It's going to be a long, arduous process to get to the bottom of it. There are going to be hundreds of people arrested and most likely convicted, but they're not leaving anything to chance on the security front. And in terms of making Washington secure again, it will happen.
Emily, from a security and political standpoint, the countries in Europe, during the 80s especially, dealt with violent factions within their own government, within their own country. We think of the Red Army. We think of the Basque separatist movement that had kidnappings, bombings, murders, these sorts of things. They were long-term things. These lasted for years and years and years. They were finally excised from that society and from those governments, but they lasted for years and years. Is the feeling around Washington among the political class that this is something that is more of a brief thing, more of a thing that sort of fades away as Trump leaves office? Or are we in for something more akin to what the European nations went through during the 80s period?
I think before January 6th, there were many people who believed that this was going to be over on January 20th, that the kind of rhetoric and conspiracy theory and the sort of threats to members of your own party, that that was going to go away when Donald Trump stopped being president. I think that January 6th drove home for a lot of people that this is not going away. And a difference from some of the European situations that you've just mentioned is that this is one of our two major political parties. I think that the Republican Party has a long road ahead of it. A new member of the Republican Party just said that she's going to bring articles of impeachment against Joe Biden on January 21st, right? So there's still this fervor for Trump and this desire to fight Biden. And I think that the polarization, the intensity of the grievance on some sides is not going away. I think a concern is that unless there is accountability for those who stormed the Capitol and those who incited the storming of the Capitol, that this could happen. This could easily happen again.
And the Democrats, Emily, are going to have a real balancing act when they come back into session. You're going to have an incoming president who has an agenda, who has, by nature, a desire to cooperate across the aisle. It's sort of his hallmark of his governing style. And then you have to balance this positioning of his political agenda with a trial of the former president. How can the Democrats sort of handle this balancing act? Is there a thought even to delaying having the trial until maybe after the first 100 days of the Biden administration to give it a chance to get up and on its feet?
They have a real, I mean, we've been talking about divisions in the Republican Party, but the Democrats have this massive task ahead of them, in particular Joe Biden. I know that he was reportedly asking Mitch McConnell and trying to get an answer from the Senate parliamentarian if they could perhaps do a half day split where half of the day is on the impeachment trial and then the other half of the day is dedicated to getting some of his nominees through the nomination process and into their jobs. The thing is that he had a massive task ahead of this before January 6th. He had the economy. He had vaccinations. We have thousands of people dying every day from COVID-19. He had going back to allies and saying, sorry, Foreign Minister of Luxembourg, that you refused to see Mike Pompeo, you know, in the last week. But if we could reestablish ties between the U.S. and Europe, all of this had to happen. And now Biden also has this. I think they will probably try to find a way to either get through the impeachment trial quickly or to have it be only part of the day or to have it so that it's not the only thing that the Biden administration is doing for the first 100 days. I will say that I think that if a mob had not stormed the Capitol, I think Biden's inclination very much would have been to try to move forward and focus on the future. But I think events clearly have forced his hand because the House impeached Trump. And so now you sort of have to deal with the past before you can look only to the future.
Dealing with that as part of moving forward. JJ, I just want to ask you about the ongoing investigations now. We've had dozens of people arrested, identified, and case files opened by the FBI. There are also reports that you alluded to earlier, there being collaboration possibly with government officials and police who may have helped the insurrection by giving even guided tours to riot people who would turn out to be leaders of the riots the next day, congressmen or congressman's staff, congressional staff. What is going to be the punishment for people who were found to have been collaborators? What happens to someone if we find out that's true?
Some people are facing the possibility of years in jail, in prison. You know, it really depends on what's found out. So I can't really answer that question, you know, from a general point of view. It was a crime. You know, that's a crime scene, as you mentioned earlier. This is a situation where there was everything from simple trespassing to assault. There was murder. There are firearms in there. You know, as you mentioned, there are situations where people say that they believe that there are members of Congress or staff that brought people in the day before to give them what they call reconnaissance tours to find places and people. These are very serious charges. And so you're talking about the possibility of prison time for some people if they are found to have done something like this. Certainly, if you're a representative or a staffer who helped facilitate something that led to murder. The other thing that I think sort of puts this into perspective, too, I still haven't confirmed this yet, but there are reports that in one particular staffer's office, Ayanna Pressley, there were panic buttons that they had installed in the office that they said they reached for those panic buttons during this problem, during this event, during this situation, and they weren't there. Those buttons had been ripped out. The chief of staff for Representative Pressley told the Boston Globe that those buttons had been torn away. If this is true, this is not something that protesters did the day of this rally. They say this had to have happened before the riots took place. So there are some very serious charges, and I would imagine very serious time if people are found to have collaborated with the people who committed those crimes in the Capitol.
I know it's unprecedented times we keep saying that, but I thank you all for really addressing these things with such insight and such knowledge and such calm. It becomes very personal when it's here in Washington, D.C. amongst us. And again, I appreciate your candor and your expertise. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panelists, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, and J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the state of religious freedom around the world and challenges for 2021. We will talk with two guests, both members of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF, an independent bipartisan federal government commission created in 1998. During the first half of the show, we will talk with Anurima Bhargava, vice chair of USERF. It aims to monitor the universal right to freedom of religion or belief abroad. According to its website, USERF uses international standards to monitor religious freedom violations globally and makes policy recommendations to the president, the secretary of state, and Congress. While religious freedom is considered America's first freedom, it also is a core human right recognized by international law and treaty and a necessary component of U.S. foreign policy and America's commitment to defending democracy and freedom globally, and a vital element of national security, critical to ensuring a more peaceful, prosperous, and stable world. In the first half of the program, we'll talk with Vice Chair Anurima Bhargava, a civil rights lawyer with extensive experience in advocating for members of underrepresented communities about the international landscape over the past year for religious freedom and challenges for 2021. In the second half, we will continue the conversation with Nuri Turkel, a commissioner of USERF. He is the first United States-educated Uyghur American lawyer and human rights advocate. And Vice Chair Anurima Bhargava joins us via Skype. Anurima, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be here.
Anurima, let's first talk about the purpose of the commission. What is, in fact, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and how was it created? What was the impetus?
Sure. So the commission was created as part of the International Religious Freedom Act. And the goal was really to make sure that as part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that the human right to be able to believe or not to believe, to be able to exercise religious freedom without fear or actuality of persecution or violence is something that communities around the world could exercise. And the commission is made up of 9 commissioners who are bipartisan. And we make recommendations to the administration, to Congress, to the State Department about how we can think about religious freedom in countries with which we are engaged. Our focus, though, different from the State Department and other agencies within the United States government, is only on religious freedom and that right.
Anurima, who is on the commission? You said it's bipartisan. How are the commissioners selected?
The commissioners, there are 9 of us, are selected by the president, by the leaders of Congress. So we have commissioners who have been selected by the Speaker of the House, by both the majority and minority leaders in the Senate, and also by the president. So there are 5 at the moment who are Republican-appointed commissioners and 4 that are Democrat-appointed commissioners. That will change as the administration changes in the coming weeks.
Anurima Bhargava, how does USERF define violations of religious freedom? Because some listeners may be wondering if USERF is perhaps trying to impose specific American values or the American concept of separation of church and state on other countries. So how does it actually define violations of religious freedom?
USERF looks to whether or not a country is engaging in systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. And that can take on many different forms. I think it's really important to recognize that USERF has advocated for religious communities of all backgrounds and faiths, and also advocates for those who choose not to believe. And so our focus is on a number of different things that we may see in countries around the world, which are we will look at laws that are imposed by governments that say you can't practice your religion unless you're officially registered, unless the government tells you you can. We look at instances in which the government has persecuted, tortured, killed, imprisoned those who are seeking to exercise their beliefs. We look at situations in which there are laws that are passed, like citizenship laws, that suggest that in order to be a citizen or to belong within a country, you have to be of a particular religious background. And we look at the ways in which there are hate rhetoric actions that are taken within a country that the government actually either encourages or sanctions in some ways. And then we look at actual laws. So there are laws on the books in many countries, blasphemy laws that suggest that a person who does not comport with what it is that the government says they should believe in, you know, will be criminalized or prosecuted for that. And those are the kinds of things that we look at in countries around the world. The issue is not to impose a sense of what religion, any particular religion that should be upheld in these countries. It's not to advocate for any particular religious community. Our goal is really to look at the places in which those who are persecuted, who may not have voice or within their country may not have voice because of the danger in being able to exercise that voice, that we can advocate for them and highlight what is going on in their countries in a way that supports them and does not continue the persecution and the danger.
Vice Chair Anurima Bhargava, I would be remiss if I didn't follow up by asking you if the events in America, in Washington, the attack on the nation's capital, to what extent that makes your job perhaps a little more difficult? How do you think the recent events in our country, the siege on the Capitol and the ongoing discussions about the responsibility of the President of the United States, have an impact on your job?
Sure. I think that the siege on our Capitol reflects the views of some that they are who America is, that they are the ones who can exercise power and privilege without any kind of repercussions for that. They have been fomented by those who have suggested to them that they are who America is, that an election and a process that includes people of all religious backgrounds, racial and ethnic backgrounds, that somehow or another that is delegitimated by the fact that the people who are of backgrounds different than theirs shouldn't be part of America and shouldn't be part of the electorate and shouldn't be part of our democracy. And I certainly think that that sentiment, which is not in line with what it is that we are trying to suggest and promote around the world, that we have tried to suggest and promote something different, which is that countries should create a space, a community, a sense of belonging for people of all different backgrounds. That certainly puts into question, you know, how we do this work when here in the United States, so much of that is being challenged violently with some degree of horror or a great degree of horror in terms of what we're seeing in the United States across the country. I do think that there are ways in which what we're seeing in terms of our own advocacy about religious freedom around the world, part of what when we say to a place like Iran or a place like China that what they are doing are human rights violations, what they are doing in terms of restricting migration, restricting rights, our human rights violations. And then we ourselves are closing our borders to people from around the world who are facing that kind of persecution. We have done that when it comes to refugees in the past couple of years during the Trump administration. And we have done that in a number of ways in terms of signaling to the world that we might advocate for their rights, but we certainly aren't going to welcome them. That is another, I think, clear way in which the United States is sending mixed messages at best about what it is that we are trying to actually represent and promote in the world.
Anurima Bhargava, do you think that the incoming Biden administration, during which you will continue to serve on the commission, will you continue to serve on the commission as the Biden administration takes power?
Yes. So the commission actually does not change. We have 2-year terms, and so they extend through different administrations. And so, yes, I will continue to serve on the commission, as will commissioners of both parties through this transition and the incoming administration.
And will the incoming Biden administration, will your work change in any way? Will priorities in terms of countries that you're looking at for violations, will there be any difference?
I do think that there will be differences in how this administration coming in will look at a wide variety of human rights violations around the world. I want to be very clear that there's a sense that religious freedom is something that is part and parcel of the Republican Party, that it is focused on Christian communities and not other communities. I think that one of the things that the commission has been very good at is making sure that we are advocating for religious communities of all different faiths, and again, also for those who seek not to believe. And I hope that in this incoming administration, there isn't a continued sense that religious freedom is something that is of a partisan note. I do believe that what we're seeing around the country, I mean, around the world, is the ways in which communities like the Uyghurs, like the Rohingya, like what we see with the rise of nationalism in places as populous as India, that those are important places, Iraq, Northeast Syria. I can continue to talk about the places in which we're seeing religious communities that are being persecuted that we have advocated for on the commission very strongly. And I certainly think it's going to be very important for this incoming administration. And I know that they are already concerned about, for example, what is happening with the Rohingya who have been in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh and are being, by many accounts, forcibly removed to Basanchar, which is an island close to Bangladesh. Those are the kinds of things that this administration has already signaled they'd be concerned about. The Uyghurs are certainly on that front. And I think it's important that it not become a partisan issue, but rather something that aligns what we're saying in terms of our values and in terms of how we look at human rights with how we advocate for religious communities around the world.
Well, speaking of the Rohingya, the Uyghurs, I wonder if you could talk about 2020 writ large and countries of particular concern, which is a category that USURF has developed to talk about worrisome areas. You mentioned India, for example, and the nationalist tendency, the tendency to discriminate against the Muslim community. Give us a sense of the countries of particular concern from 2020 and going into 2021.
Sure. So the commission makes recommendations to the State Department as to whether or not we think that a country should be one of particular concerns, which means that it's engaged in systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. And I want to start with some of the bright spots of 2020 for a moment, because we often don't have the bandwidth or space to talk about them. And I started the year 2020 in Sudan. I went on a visit with USURF to Sudan, where we have actually seen over the course of the last 18, 19 months, a complete transformation in terms of the ways in which religious communities are being supported and included within the Sudanese government, culture, community. And that started with a joint civilian-military transitional government that came into place that basically has repealed public order laws that basically dictated how women could walk and participate in public, that have addressed guardianship laws, that have addressed blasphemy and apostasy, that have changed the curriculum that previously had taken a pretty hard and narrow exclusive reading of Sudan being an Islamist country, and has really opened up. For example, this past Christmas, the Sudanese government encouraged people of all religious backgrounds to celebrate Christmas with their Christian neighbors and community members. And so we have seen an about face in Sudan, and I think in many ways, they are leading the path to being able to not only reconcile, but also really put into place the kind of not only laws, but norms and standards that can create a different kind of community, a different kind of sense of belonging for people going forward, certainly led by women around the country, which has been extraordinary part of this process for them. And so we took Sudan, who had been on the country of particular concern list, and placed them on our special watch list. And we are continuing to be encouraged by what happened in 2020. To look at, you know, whether or not Sudan has made such progress that it no longer is engaging in systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. So that's one example. Uzbekistan is another in which we have seen real efforts at legal and policy reform by the government in conjunction with international support and engagement to try and change the way in which the trajectory of religious freedom is taking place in Uzbekistan. We did, as you mentioned, recommend that India, based on what happened in 2019 with both the Citizenship Amendment Act, which targeted Muslims in a number of different ways, but also increasing violence and hate towards Muslims, towards other religious minorities around the country, going into 2020, when we've seen, you know, a number of real threats to those who are speaking out and trying to support those in various religious communities. And frankly, some of the policy and legal reforms that we're seeing in 2019 that were problematic continued into 2020. And so India is a place where we are certainly looking at and engaged and concerned about the ways in which things have been turning, which is true of other such, seeing a sort of rise of ethno-nationalism, not only in India, but in Malaysia and Indonesia, in Brunei. And COVID, for a number of reasons, has been something that has exacerbated that, because there are ways in which COVID has been used to suggest that, you know, certain religious communities are the reason for COVID and the reason for the spread of COVID, which in an already imperiled situation has been something that we've been very concerned about.
That's really fascinating, using the cover of COVID. But we're seeing that also in political repression. Many countries are are using COVID as an excuse to postpone elections or close down channels of communication and dissent and so forth. So looking ahead, what are you looking at in terms of challenges for 2021?
I think 2021 is going to bring a number of challenges. We are worried about what's happening in Nigeria, where there has long been concerns about what's happening with Boko Haram and what we call entities of particular concern. But we've seen some of that increase in the last couple of months going into 2021. I certainly think that what is happening in India is going to be of continued concern. And then there are places that have been on the list as a country of particular concern for a very long time. Those include, you know, some of the ones I just mentioned. India was just put on the list this past year. But I would be remiss not to mention what's happening. We've seen just torturous conditions in places like Turkmenistan and Tajikistan that people don't usually think about or talk about, and in places like Russia. And I was heartened to see that what has been happening in Chechnya, in particular to LGBTI communities in Chechnya, that there were sanctions placed by the United States on Kadyrov and others in Chechnya for those acts and the torture and killing of LGBTQI community members in that part of the country. And so there are things that are being called out in different ways, but certainly what we've seen and what we're seeing in Iran and North Korea and in places where we have and will continue to see not only problems of political repression, but certainly of religious communities as well. I think in places like Pakistan, where the ways in which blasphemy laws are being enforced, the ways in which the Ahmadi community and other smaller religious communities like the Hindus and Christians are being targeted, particularly during COVID, I think are all places where we continue to have concerns.
Anurima Bhargava, are there trends that you're seeing globally with regard to religious freedom?
I do think that there are. And one of the things that the commission has tried to do over the past year is to hold hearings on areas that we think are cross-cutting, that are trends in the ways in which countries are persecuting religious communities across borders, and not only across borders, but within their own countries. And so a couple of those, certainly as we've seen around the world and in the United States, the use of social media platforms, of technology, of surveillance to really not only perpetuate hate and persecution of religious communities and to have that go unchecked, but also to really survey religious communities and stop their ability to practice, to move, to engage, to live, to survive. We've seen that in many countries around the world, and I think will be something that is a continuing trend in 2021 and beyond. The second area I think that we highlighted in a hearing we had last March was the ways in which citizenship has been used as a way to persecute religious communities and, frankly, to drive them out. And so we saw that in Burma with the Rohingya. Citizenship was the way in which to suggest that the Rohingya were no longer part of Burma, even though they had been part of the country and had lived there for generations. We have seen the same kind of tool being used in India and, again, in other countries around the world. And so this question of how citizenship aligns with your religious identity or background is another trend that we're concerned about in terms of how it plays out in 2021 and beyond.
Anurima Bhargava is vice chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Anurima, thank you so much for your terrific insights, for kicking off our discussion about the state of religious freedom around the world.
Thank you so much, Carol.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Twitter follower, Robert from Lusaka, Zambia. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Our next guest, Nuri Turkel, is a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. According to USERF's website, Nuri is the first U.S.-educated Uyghur American lawyer and human rights advocate. He was born in a re-education camp at the height of China's Cultural Revolution and spent the first several months of his life in detention with his mother. He came to the United States in 1995 as a student and was granted asylum in 1998. Nuri Turkel has testified before Congress, including most recently before the Congressional Executive Commission on China in October 2019, speaking about Uyghur internment camps and advocating a legislative response to China's actions. Many of his recommendations have been incorporated into U.S. laws and pending bills related to Uyghurs and China in Congress, including the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2020. And Nuri Türkel joins us via Skype. Nuri Türkel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
The first question for you is, because of your Uyghur background, talk about the plight of the Uyghur in China and why Beijing has singled them out, this Muslim minority, for marginalization, discrimination, and repression, and what they call re-education, but which we know is more like a form of brainwashing, and some analysts say even a form of persecution.
Thank you very much. Uyghurs are Turkic people with a rich history, culture, and tradition. We speak Uyghur language, which is close to Uzbek language, as well as the Kazakhs and Kyrgyz language, as well as the language spoken in Turkey today, but also have a lot of cultural and historic connections to the people of Eurasia. According to the Chinese official estimate, there are about 12 million Uyghurs within the Chinese proper. But the Uyghur scholars, Uyghur activists, and NGOs believe that the number could be anywhere around 20 million worldwide. The Chinese government has been implementing some of the worst forms of human rights abuses since its occupation in 1949 with the help of Stalin's Soviet Union. They implemented different policies, used different slogans, different justification, anywhere from a counter-revolutionary to a separatist terrorist that now the Chinese government, using its economic power, diplomatic influence, and the technology to engage in modern-day genocide, with the intent to break Uyghurs' lineage, their roots, their origin, and eliminate their culture, religion, and identity. United States government has been calling China out for its attempt to stamp out the Uyghur culture, Uyghur identity, and destroy Uyghur religious practices. The Chinese government publicly say that they are engaging in a policy or implementing policy to transform Uyghurs into a normal human being. So the transformation is a code word for indoctrination, if you will, in the mildest form. But when you look at the communist history, whether it be in Central Eastern Europe during the Cold War or now in China, they're always about transforming something. What that means is that they're forcing you to give up your way of life, forcing you to give up your religious practices and show loyalty, utmost loyalty to the Communist Party and pledge allegiance to the country, the nation, the government, and also worship not your God, but Xi Jinping. There's a thing called the Xi Jinping thoughts that the so-called re-education camps force the Uyghurs to learn, study for hours daily. These are not re-education camps. You don't re-educate somebody who has already an advanced degree, someone who's already fluent in the Chinese language, somebody who's already had very successful, accomplished professional life. What this is a concentration camp. Here's why. They believe that this has to be extrajudicial. This has to be collective. This has to be ethnic and religious purposes. So these camps are very much similar to the ones that we've seen in history. Extrajudicial, collective, targeted on ethnicity and religious background, and there's no end in sight. The most jarring aspect of this modern-day concentration camps and China's genocidal policy is the issue of forced labor and the issue of child separation. And also recently, we've been told that they are engaging in forced sterilization of Uyghur women. Today, in American stores, if it was not for the action by the United States government, especially the African-American community, would have been using the beauty products, the Vicks, made of Uyghur prisoners' hair. And also the forced labor. More than 80% of the China-made cotton products are sourced in the Uyghur region. During the period of April 2019 through April 2020, the export volume from that region to the United States have increased 250%. According to the New York Times, even the PPEs, personal protective equipment, that have been used by consumers, by healthcare providers in the hospitals during this pandemic, believed to be made by enslaved Uyghurs. We were talking about industrial scale prison system. What we're talking about, China's deliberate systematic attempts over the years to pollute global supply chain. Now we're talking about polluted global economic system.
What you're saying, Nuri, sounds like to me that there's a
lot of convergence between what the Trump administration was trying to do by calling out China and its mistreatment of the Uyghur population and the incoming Biden administration. And so on that, let me ask you, how has your identity as a Uyghur, how has that helped you in your role as commissioner at USCIRF? And what measures has USCIRF recommended that the U.S. take to pressure Beijing to reverse this mistreatment of the Uyghur population?
I am a Uyghur immigrant, especially I'm realizing more and more after I'm appointed to serve in this government entity, where the Chinese government engaging in war on faith in China against the Buddhist Tibetans, against the Christian Chinese, and against the Uyghur Muslims. So me being part of that oppressed minority, now representing the United States government on this important issues, speaks volume how much our government cares about these fundamental rights. Religious freedom is the first human right for American people. It's in our Constitution. It's in the Declaration of Independence. Protection of religious freedom, individual freedom, human rights is in the gene of American people, but it's part of who we are. So it's been an amazing experience being part of this commission to advance religious freedom, not only for the Uyghur people, but for the others whose voices have not been heard. My focus have been mostly in China, but also have been monitoring religious freedom issues in Eurasia, Central Asia to be specific, and Middle East. More recently, I've also been focusing on the disturbing trends in Europe, rise of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. So some countries, some governments mistakenly believe that taking a hardline position on religious minority will help them to achieve the so-called social stability and national security. But they're missing the point. Religious repression, going after religious minorities, actually will create more unrest, more resentment, potentially a threat against that regime. Religious persecution is crime against humanity. Religious persecution is a precursor to genocide, as we have seen throughout history. Therefore, countries that respect religious freedom, human rights, tend to have more stable and secure societies. Their citizens' rights, their citizens' safety guarantees when their rights to practice their religion is protected.
Noor Turkel, it's going to be a major challenge to confront the Communist Party of China. Talk about what you have achieved with respect to the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2020 and what you're hoping to achieve in 2021.
2 points. One, USCIRF as a government advisory body have taken a very strong position early on, even when this was not widely discussed. We have officially asked the Secretary of State to make an official determination on atrocities. We have endorsed and supported both Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act as well as the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act that is currently being considered in the United States Congress. In addition to that, we have been using the tools such as social media, hearings, public statements and op-eds to raise awareness with specific policy recommendations. As a result, we have been making some progress. The global Magnitsky sanction has been implemented on 4 Chinese officials. United States government has sanctioned this paramilitary unit called Xinjiang Production Construction Corp. that has about 800,000 shell companies around the world that has been largely responsible for production and exportation of forced labor products. And also, we have been encouraging the United States government to bring our allies and partners into the fold to address China's genocidal policies and religious persecution, particularly being implemented against the Uyghur people. So the UHRP Act was enacted in June 2020. Some of the provisions already been implemented. We anticipate that the incoming administration will continue the policy and legislative responses that the previous Congress and current administration put in place. At the end of the day, this is for the international community. The scale and scope of the crisis cries out for global condemnation, collective and individual responses.
Noor Turkel is a commissioner at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote.